everybody. This is Tim Green with Rattle Magazine. Welcome to Rattlecast number 50. 50 episodes. I feel like we should have a drink or a cigar or something. Thanks for joining us through 50 episodes. Tonight's guest is David Rumpvet, who is a wonderful poet, as we always have wonderful poets, but this is going to be a really interesting discussion, and looking forward to that in just a little bit. Make sure everything works here before we start going. We are streaming on Periscope and Twitter again, I should say, after there was a button that I accidentally clicked, which made it not work. So if you're ever trying to Periscope, do not click low latency mode if you want to have a high definition video, because it doesn't work in low latency mode. Now, for the warm-up poem today, I just clicked the random button as always, and it came upon one of my favorite poems from the Young Poets Anthology. Now, this was a 2014, so one of the very first Rattle Young Poets Anthology that we did. And this is Kofi Adufu, a Nigerian poet, age 7, reading this amazing poem called Making Noise. And I'm gonna play it once so that you can hear Kofi read it, and then I will read it again, because there was a thick accent, and the sound quality is not the best, so you might not be able to hear it. So I'll play it once, and I'll read it myself once. It's short. It's 45 seconds. So here we go. Here is Kofi Adufu reading Making Noise.
I'm Kofi Adufu, making noise. The dead dog snores, making noise in the world, full of moths. I can name two moths belonging to my late friends, a cat and a fowl. I see the sun on the fish. I tell a guest at the party where little else is eating. A man's word, he tells me with a wink. This entire time, today is the kind of memorial day. Quality shots, deep and long from the eyes. Home is closer to sunset. Everybody looks at the foot coming back.
Once again, that was Kofi Adufu reading Making Noise. And here it is. I'll read it for you again. And I love this line. Whom I feed the sun on the face. I asked him if it was a typo, and he said, no, I feed the sun on the face. So here we go. This is Making Noise by Kofi Adufu. The dead dog snores, making noise in the world full of mounds. I can name two mounds belonging to my late friends, a cat and a fowl, whom I feed the sun on the face. I tell the guest at the party where little else is eaten. A man's world, he tells me with a wink. His entire town today is the kind of memorial day, collecting shells deep and long from the eyes. Home is closer to sunset. Everybody looks at the foot coming back. And that is Kofi Adufu at age 7. He must be, I guess that was 2014, so he would be 14 or 13 maybe now, from the first Rattle Young Poets Anthology. And that's our warm-up poem for today. Hope you enjoyed that. Now, let's move on to our guest. David Rumpvet is his newest book is Dilemmas of the Angels, and he's also does a lot of translations of Basque poetry. He's had poems in 5 issues of Rattle, including the forthcoming issue, number 68, this fall. And he's a professor of creative writing at the University of Wyoming, the author of more than a dozen books. He has also served as the poet laureate of Wyoming, and with the bands Aspa and the Fire Ants playing the button accordion. You can find more of his work at David Rumpvet. That is David, RomptVet.com, DavidRomptVet.com. And here he is, David Rumpvet. How are you doing, David?
I am fine. Thank you very much, Tim.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Do you want to start us out?
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to meet all these poets. We met one time at the AWP conference, I remember. And you played that button accordion, and really the most memorable thing of the whole weekend, I think, was you playing that and playing a song too, reading a poem while playing the accordion. I don't know if you have that.
Yeah, I have tended sometimes to try and figure out a way to bring the music and the poetry together. For many, many years, I played traditional musics of the Americas, what we call dance music of the Americas. And I would go to these festivals where you'd hear traditional music, whether it was old-time Appalachian music, Quebec music, klezmer music, Cajun music. I never met any other poets, and I always thought it was very odd that somehow these worlds were so separate. And one friend, finally, I met a banjo player from Seattle who was a poet, a working poet, like all of us. And I asked her about it. I said, it's so odd. We never meet anyone else. She said, what are you, nuts? We, as poets, are like shishi high art, right? And playing this music we play is total lowbrow stuff. So the lowbrow, highbrow worlds don't cross, was her opinion of it. I don't know, but I sometimes think I'm going to figure out a way to bring them together a little
bit. Well, I think we did the slam poetry issue almost, I think it was like 15 years ago almost. And I've been meaning ever since to do a musician poets issue and have a CD accompanying, although maybe that's antiquated. Maybe we should have like a download. But at the time, with the slam.
Nobody has a CD.
I know, exactly. So I guess we shouldn't have a CD tucked in there, but we could have maybe like a QR code to get to a MP3 from the website or something, but to include audio with it would be really cool. That's something we've always meant to do. Well, do you want to read a poem to start out? I don't know what you wanted to start with. We have your new and selected. We have Dilemmas of the Angels, and we have, or not new and selected, but your newest book, No Way. And then we have the translations too. Where do you want to start?
Well, what would you like? Do you have a personal preference about any of this stuff?
I don't. I mean, where do you want to go first? That's okay. The only question, really. Well, I mean, everything is really fascinating. So I'm curious about all of it.
I am interested a little bit in the fact that for much of my life, I have admired poets who I thought were bold, sturdy, strong-willed. Maybe some people might even say aggressive in the expression of social, working on behalf of the social good, as it were. A poet, I love two poets I've liked quite a lot. One is Adrian Lewis. I don't know if you know Adrian
yeah,
C. Lewis.
Yeah,
is a Paiute poet. And another one that I liked older, like a generation earlier, was Philip Levine, a poet who's working now who kind of is in a different place, but I admire a great deal, is Kim Adonizio. And they're all poets who seem so bold to me in some ways, who say what they feel like and don't worry. And I've always felt, Arambet, you're too weeny in some way, But there's another part of me that thinks all of us as poets have things we can and can't do, ways in which we can speak productively, maybe, for our society and ourselves. And I've discovered, I think, as I age, I'm getting to be quite the old guy, that often when I simply try to speak out of some kind of love for individuals, for nature and the natural world, for the environment in which I live, the poems seem to actually touch people in some way more than when I try to say something I think is important or matters. I don't know. So one of the poems in Dilemmas of the Angels that has had this kind of response, or people has elicited a response that seems to be something that surprised me a little bit, because I thought it's pretty simple, is the very first one. It's called Sunday Morning Early. I'll read that one.
Sure.
Okay. Sunday morning early. My daughter and I paddle red kayaks across the lake. Pulling hard, we slip easily through the water. Far from either shore, it hits me that my daughter is a young woman. And suddenly, everything is a metaphor for how short a time we are granted. The red boats on the blue-black water, the russet and gold of late summer's grasses, the empty sky. We stop and listen to the stillness. I say, it's Sunday, and here we are in the church of the out-of-doors. Then wish I'd kept quiet. That's the trick in life, learning to leave well enough alone. Our boats drift to where the chirring of grasshoppers reaches us from the rocky hills, a clap of thunder. I want to say something truer than I love you. I want my daughter to know that through her, I live a life that was closed to me. I paddle up, lean out, and touch her hand. I start to speak, then stop. So it's pretty simple, It's pretty straightforward in some ways, too. One thing that I'd never thought about very much until right now, reading it for you, Tim, is the line where it says that I lived through my daughter a life that was closed to me before. Now, a reader, a listener, would have no idea. What is that closure? Was that a person who had no parents, who was an orphan? Was that a person who was abused in childhood? Was that a person who never knew what life could be through no fault of anyone else but their own limitations? We can't possibly say. And I realize that a lot of what I try to do is find a way to speak something that will be pretty straightforward on the surface of it and yet have layers that go down. So I don't know if you know the children's writer, Philip Pullman.
No, I don't.
You know this name?
No, I don't.
Pullman's pretty prominent children's young adult books he writes, and he wrote a series called His Dark Materials.
Oh,
they're
I have
based
heard of that,
on
yeah.
John Milton. And the first one was made into a big movie, which the Vatican went nuts about, The Golden Compass, and told Catholics they should not see because it might lead them to read his books. And in his books, he's got this little device, a thing called a lithiometer. It's a truth teller in the vehicle of the book. And the truth teller has layers of meaning, sort of like the Yi Jing mm-hmm. in ancient Chinese divination. And so I think as a poet, I'm trying to do that with a surface that, if I put it in my most weeny way, would be a non-threatening surface, a non-fear-inducing surface, but that something else we hope can happen at levels that aren't right there in front of you if you choose to go there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up that line, because as I was reading the book this morning, I was thinking about that line a lot, because for me, having a daughter really changed my life in a way that was just, I mean, I can't even quantify the amount of shift. You know, it was because I was like a sort of a like a laid back, like Buddhist kind of like, who cares? Like, if I die, I don't even care. And then as soon as she was born, my entire personality changed. And I realized that I can't die because I'm responsible for this other thing. And it really changed everything about my entire personality. And I can never go back, I think. Like, there's just so much meaning and importance to everything. I did notice too that you have a lot of poems about your daughter in this book.
Yes, it's the first time I've written a number of poems in which she plays a central role.
Yeah, so
that was interesting too.
So I was wondering what you felt that completeness meant to you, because for me it was a sense of meaning that just didn't exist in life. Like, it was really easy to sort of go around in this sort of abstract and distant way where I wasn't attached to anything. And now I'm sort of permanently attached, like, for better and worse. Like, it makes, like, I actually have anxiety, which I never had before, about, like, the state of the world and things. And it's just, it's such a huge shift. So what was that completeness for you, though? Because I think it was probably something completely different than it was for me. That's kind of what I was thinking about reading that book or the poem.
Well, most people I know can say something like what you said, a major transformation in their lives when they have children. And I am a person also who generally can't write about anything until it's so far gone from me that nobody else could possibly care about it. You know what I mean? In other words, I don't write about her infancy when she's an infant. I write about her infancy when she's 30, yeah. That kind of thing. Or, for example, there are also a lot of rather grim poems in Dilemmas set in Africa, where I lived in the late 70s. But those poems were written between 2013 and 2017. So they were written, you know, 30, 35 years after the events that I experienced. And so that's part of it. And then with the daughter, to directly answer your question a little better, I grew up, my particular situation was one in which I did have a pretty grim childhood with an emotionally unstable and violent father. And my solution to my problems as a child and young person was to not feel things, not have feeling. And so a major chore in my adult life has been to learn how to feel. And I've felt that when I had a child, I was suddenly presented with the necessity of learning how to feel, to feel what had to be done, to feel what was right to do, to actually experience connection. You mentioned that you were a floating guy. I'm not sure this is Buddhism, Tim, but okay, we'll just call it that. And that you suddenly had responsibility and started feeling anxiety. And this weird one, like everybody knows, the stereotypical notion about parenting is that a parent cannot outlive his or her child. The child goes on, the parent dies first. When parents have their children die first, it's usually completely devastating because it's out of the realm of what's supposed to happen.
Uh-oh. He froze for a second. Hang on. Hey, David. Yeah, we lost you for a second. I'm sorry about that.
How'd we lose that?
I don't know. Just,
life.
You know what happens is when we do tests sometimes, it's like a different time. And then this is the time of day, you know, it just became 7 o'clock. People are starting to stream all their Netflix. and there's not enough like community bandwidth, I think. And then and so so we have a little more dropouts on now that on the test. But you were talking about your
Where'd you lose me?
You were talking about your you were talking about your daughter and it wasn't too far ago. It was I was going to say though that it's interesting that you bring up that state of you know, having to negotiate emotion, because that was the same kind of thing for me too. Actually, it was that you know, I had sort of an unstable childhood a little bit. There wasn't a lot of consistency, and there was a father kind of like that, and so I distanced myself from everything, and then I had to have a connection, which is what the meaning sort of came from. So it's really cool to hear you put it that way.
You know, the other thing that I noticed, I had a dear friend. When I went to college, this is an interesting thing, I think. My father filed felony runaway charges against me.
Oh, wow.
Because I was a minor, and he didn't want me to go to college.
Oh, wow.
So there was a whole complicated mess with the police. I grew up in Arizona. I went to college in Oregon. So Oregon police and Arizona police had to get with the dean of the college. They had to convince my father to drop the charges and let me go to college. My first college roommate was a Canadian young man who I became very close to him and his entire family, big family. And he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when we were seniors in college and had a very serious case and died fairly young. When he died, we had a huge ceremony with people from all over North America and Europe who were his friends, spreading his ashes in English Bay at Vancouver, BC. And his brother took me aside at one point and said he felt that what came to him from all his experiences with his family and brother was a responsibility to do your best to be of good cheer for others. And I thought there's something in that too. When you had a child, I suddenly wasn't allowed to be cranky all the time and I couldn't whine anymore because I sort of had some responsibility to help that child not become a whining, cranky person, you know. So that was a big part of it too.
Yeah. Yeah. You just get hit like with a hammer of responsibility all of a sudden.
Yeah. So would you mind if I read two more of the poems
from
Dilemmas?
Yeah, please do. That'd be great.
With
and I forgot
these
to,
things.
Yeah. I forgot to tell you, but say the page number before so I can flip to it quick, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So the one I thought about two because they represent this family background that I tried to escape and that the poems often deal with, one about my father and one about my mother. Which is, I mean, of course, they're about other things. But so it's on page five, very early, Birds Singing for Jesus. You see that one? Here we go. Birds Singing for Jesus. Jesus was a carpenter, but it's hard to picture him hiding nails. Mornings at work, then sharing a sandwich, a coarse joke, later walking to the olive grove to take a leak. He was also a preacher whose gaze and cool tone made his listeners long to touch him. But he was so famously indifferent to sex that it seems pornographic to picture him in bed with a wife, his leg thrown over hers, much less an erection. It's easier to speak of the bitter fruit of paternity, that crown of thorns, and what would it feel like to be the one human, only half born of humanity? When Jesus hung on the cross, there was little for the Roman guards to do. They put down their spears and pulled off their helmets. They cut slivers of wood to clean their teeth. Pitched coins at a rock and bet on which would land closest, kicked a wad of rags around in the dust and lifting their arms above their heads, yelled, "Goal!" At sunset, they lowered the dead man to earth. Here we are then, strange and ordinary, climbing down from our crosses to drive trucks or repair TVs, to cut meat or harvest soybeans. Today, I got a letter from my father, who died in 1950, 2 weeks before I was born. The postman explained nothing. My father said his greatest regret was that we would never meet. He'd already started writing when a nurse said, "The rain stopped. Wouldn't you like to look out the window?" She propped him up with pillows, and he saw the sun on the metal surfaces of the cars, on the galvanized blades of the rooftop ventilators, and on a puddle where a flock of sparrows was bathing. They flapped their wings, and the water flew up, refracting the light. "Those birds," he wrote, "were singing away like they were giving a concert, even if I was the only person who'd come." There's no letter. I was an adult when my father died, an unhappy, not quite old man. He was a carpenter, but I don't believe he could have worked on a crew with Jesus. He could hardly work with anyone. Still, I wanted to have another chance. I wanted those birds to be singing for him. So that's kind of interesting because it doesn't really deal with all the misery of that guy's life and then the life that he helped the rest of us to live in misery too. And my mother was a very passive character who in many ways we feared did not do the job protecting her children that maybe we expect should happen. Here's the other poem. Okay?
Mm-hmm. What page?
Housework. It's on page 63 okay. of that book, if you want to look at it.
Go ahead.
Got it? Housework. I'm on a stepladder, spackling a crack that opened in the wall after an earthquake. My father did this same work. At home, he hit my mother. How soft her face was. She told him, never again. When he hit his children, she stayed quiet. Even in small earthquakes, there are aftershocks, and this one's no different. The ground shaking again. I climb down the ladder and sit on the floor. My father away, my mother made us sandwiches, then gave the silent blessing. Holding hands, I hope she couldn't read my thoughts. Not that he hit us that often. I mean, maybe, you know, I'm exaggerating. I look out the window and watch the leaves trembling on the trees. For 40 years, she grew quieter, one day whispering that she felt short of breath, that her breathing wasn't right. She couldn't breathe. I get the broom and sweep up breadcrumbs and lint and hair. I scrub the toilet, then attack the ring in the tub. It's hot, and sweat drips into my eyes. My mother died without a word to me, nor I to her. Who knows when the house will stop shaking, if it's worth spackling the crack.
There are two more poems from Dilemmas of the Angels. That was Housework, David Ronfett's most recent book. You know, David, one of the things I noticed, we made the poem of the day today, was on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
And in the version, to preview this episode, and in the version that we published, though, it was your uncle and your Aunt Jane. And then it shifted in the book to your mother. And what's that?
Did you get the poem from a magazine?
It was from Rattle. We published it in Rattle.
Oh, it was the Rattle version.
Yeah, it was the Rattle version.
That's
from
great.
From, I don't know, 2008 or something like that.
And so ask your question.
Yeah, so I was just wondering about that transition and how, because I think people are afraid to not be factually accurate in poems. And I always kind of distinguish in myself between facts and truths. And I think the truth is a deeper sort of thing that is true through iterations, but facts are sort of the details that happen to be in this universe. So I don't worry so much about facts, but this is one big disagreement me and Alan, our founding editor, have. Is that Alan wants things to be factually accurate, and I do not care. So so where do you stand about it, and why did you make the why did you change that poem?
This is a fantastic and interesting dilemma that people deal with all the time. I'll tell you a couple of stories that I think relate directly to what you're asking and hope it will answer. First, just as a statement, I don't think poetry is nonfiction. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's like writing a physics book or a history book, or even it's not a memoir. A memoir is a memoir. Poems are poems. They might be fictional. They might make really clear direct use of the poet's life, or they may not. There's a poem that I wrote once about my second daughter. And in the poem, the speaker talks about the daughter coming forward when the new child is born, the new baby is born, and asking about the facts of life. And the mother tries to explain the facts of life. And the father says, I don't think I would have said it that way, but, you know, she's asking. And ultimately, the child becomes very interested in the Bible, especially the virgin birth, because the mother says, someday you're going to have this kind of relation, maybe. And the girl says, no, if my body tells me to do that, I'm not listening. So then there's this funny thing about the Bible and sex and all that. I read this poem and a woman came up to me afterwards and said how much she liked the poem and especially liked the portrayal of the two girls and the relationship and what had happened to them as they grew up. And I said, well, you know, I made up the second daughter. I don't have a second daughter. It's for the story. It's this story about what might happen to a child coming into this kind of awareness. And the woman said to me, Well, thank you very much, but I will never read a word you write again
Wow.
because you've lied to me. You've made up this child that isn't a real child and stuck it in a poem, and a poem should be autobiographical. And I think, as you said, there are many, many people who feel that the poet's material is primarily, and perhaps for some readers, exclusively, the poet's very real, fact-based life. And what I'm trying to do in my work is find a way to speak an emotional truth, which may require the transformation of some things to build that truth. So, for example, I also don't write books of poems by writing poems blah, 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 for 5 years and then throwing them all on the floor and picking what I think are the 50 best. Instead, I try to work some kind of thematic motion and some kind of interplay. For example, in Dilemmas, it's hugely important that those Africa poems get crossed with the family daughter poems, that the kind of grace and beauty, the good luck of the family life is crossed with the pain of the time when I worked and lived in Africa and the harshness of the kind of world in which I lived there, which was way before I ever was a father or met the person who's the mother of my daughter, you know, that kind of thing. And so to build a thematic material, sometimes it's like, whoops, can't be Jane anymore. It's got to be somebody else. The same material is there. The Broadway event never really happened with my real father. That would be something he never would have done. That father's a creation for the book, for the emotional veracity of the book, not for my life. So, and part of that, I think, Tim, I feel pretty strongly, but there's a part of me that thinks maybe it's the residue of being afraid of feeling. Does that make sense? In other words, I can be a fiction writer as a poet too. I don't have to just depend upon my feelings, because you know what? I don't want to feel them. So sometimes I think there's a little bit of that. I'm sure that we all have reasons that are maybe sometimes hidden from ourselves or others as to why we make a doctrinal, an ideological, a literary decision about how to conduct ourselves. And so while I'm aware of that, I still think sometimes it's easier for me to try to create a frame for emotion that feels real. Plus, I think a part of me feels like, well, at least I'm a real writer. I made something up, you know, because I think part of my job is to make things up. I know that I'm not dissing autobiographical writing, because I know that all writing is making things up because you have to select. There's this massive fabric of a billion things happening all the time. You select and you condense to get the thing you want.
And our memories are
That's.
all corrupted, and the
Oh,
frame
yeah.
changes everything, no matter what we're talking about, and the perspectives and things like that too. People are saying, people are completely disagreeing with that woman. And Caitlin Buxman says, "I wouldn't have told her," and that's an asshole-y
I
thing for
wouldn't
her
have
to
told her.
say. And it makes me
Is
wonder
this in the
though.
chat? Are you looking at the chat?
And everybody's sort of agreeing on the chat window. So I'm wondering, because that is something that comes up a lot. People, like readers, or maybe just lay readers who aren't poets themselves, it might be, tend to want the poems to be real. And what do you think about the white lie of just pretending it's real to a reader like
You mean
that?
like one of the people in the chat said, why did you even tell that person? I say, oh, they're doing fine. But my second one's in high school now. The other one's off to college. Well,
I mean, I
I
wonder,
don't know.
like, I have the same compulsion to tell the truth too much, I think, where it does harm. And really, it's a serious question, though. If her joy that she got out of the poem, or her, the meaning for it was lost a little bit because you told her the truth about it.
I kind of wrecked the poem for her.
And is there a reason? Is it like what is the moral thing to do? Might it be just to lie? Is that possible, or is it always moral to tell the truth when asked?
Well, Tim, I'll leave morality in this poem to you, but I will say that it might have been more effective. It might not have mattered. I might not have needed, but I got to say, I didn't really plan to tell the truth. It just came out because when she asked without thinking, I just said, oh, you know, I don't really have a second daughter. It didn't occur to me to say, now I need to tell the truth so she knows that poetry is fiction. It just was, I get a question, so I answered it. So, and in that context, I don't think about risks. Now, there are many places where I would think about risk factors in telling the truth, right? And might be more cautious, more careful.
Yeah.
We live in a world filled with caution and care about how we talk to one another. So I am aware of that. But in this case, I just felt as though, I think maybe partially because of teaching and with my students as a teacher of poetry, I try to help them feel confident that they can be free to invent, that they don't have to be completely bound. Because sometimes they do want to make up, especially young poets. They like making things up. They often start in the world of fantasy. Many start in science fiction and come to even poetry from reading science fiction, children's fantasy novels. And that's what they've read. And they start writing in middle school or high school. And even as they get to college with undergraduate writers, they sometimes are fearful. Am I allowed to do this when I'm taking a creative writing class writing poems? Can I create a character who never existed and then make that character cross with a living character? In some ways, all we're talking about there is what 25, 30 years ago was sort of new way of looking at fiction. You know, the genre bending problem of, is this a novel or is this nonfiction? And we've seen it in many negative ways, you know, the billion pieces of gold problem in the commercial world. Or the even the older one, The Education of Little Tree, which was an invented native character. You know this novel?
I don't know that one, no.
It's the story of a native man in the Carolinas and his power and majesty as a human being, but he never existed. He was falsely written by an Anglo-white American writer who made a pretense of creating this guy and gotten a lot of hot water because he presented it as true. He didn't say, I've just made up this character.
Yeah.
He said, this is a person. And gave the name, and the book was published that way. So, you know, there are risks in all that. But
yeah. Well, that goes back to all the way to Robinson Crusoe, right? Who pretended he was actually, you know, lost on an island. And we probably wouldn't know that name unless he did. Like, if he told the truth and said, I wrote a story that was fake, we wouldn't have that as part of our, you know, cultural heritage, I guess you could say.
Yeah, there is something to that, too, because people, they're more shocked if it really happened. Right? You know, something terrible, something explosive, something fascinating, something wild. That really happened. For many people, it's wow. And of course, it is wow. Things are strange that happen like that. But there's another part, which is the inner life of it, is the story told in a way. I've read some things recently where I thought the premise is fantastic, like if it were a real event. But it's not very well told. And then I think, but don't you want to give me the inner life of the event a little bit too, so I can really become engaged fully with it?
Yeah. Maybe that's a good transition, because to the book of translations that you have, Guernicaco Arbola.
Yeah, good job.
Did
Tim.
I do that even close? Not even close.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's good.
And because I can't remember how to pronounce it in the Basque either.
You want me to say
you,
his name?
You please say it for me.
Okay, the author's name is Jose Mari Iparraguirre.
Yeah, there you go. Jose Mari Iparraguirre. So he led in a life that you would almost think is fiction. I mean, it was such a rich, I mean, I was counting in your foreword, by the age of 36, he was exiled, I think, five separate times from different places.
Yeah.
And started. Can you tell us a little bit about this poet that you translated?
Well, this poet is a Basque poet. Basque literature and Basque culture is, to some degree, still a little known in the United States and at large in the world, but getting to be more and more known. The 19th century was a grim time for Basque people. Some people would know of the Carlist Wars, which were wars over the succession of the Spanish monarchy and whether Spain would move towards a more French-style pre-capitalist, moving into capitalist society, a more business-oriented society rather than a traditional church-run society. So Carlos was a pretender to the throne, and the Basque supported Carlos because he would guarantee their rights of autonomy, the historical rights of the Basque people. This poet, Jose Mari, was born in 1820. He fought in the first Carlist Wars. He was a soldier in 1844 as a 14-year-old kid. He ran away from home which was in Madrid. His parents had moved to Madrid, hoping to send him to a fancy prep school to become a priest. But he just took off and went back to the Basque Country and enlisted in the Carlist armies and fought there. He was injured several times, of course, exiled when the Carlists lost. He ends up in France, ends up fighting in the 1848 French Revolution, gets exiled, goes to England, comes back to Spain because a Spanish general who admired his work, he was a singer-songwriter, really, a troubadour of the time, and played guitar and wrote poems that were set to music, brought him back. The general got him a pardon so he could come back to the Basque Country and Spain, because the part he was from was governed by Spain. Then he got in trouble again because he wrote Guernicaco Arbola. And this is a great classic thing. Arbola, if people speak Spanish or French, it means tree. They will recognize, oh, that's arbol in Spanish, or that's arbre in French. But it's not a Basque word. It's a 19th century. It's like they spoke their version of what we call Spanglish in the U.S., only it's Basque and Spanish mixed up. Like the word for tree is suaitz. So it should be Guernicaco Suaitza, but he wrote arbola. We just call it arbola, everybody. Too bad. You know, that's what he wrote in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, he ends up in flight again, and he goes to South America because he's kicked out of Spain. He gave a reading and performance of his songs and poems at which 6,000 people came. Tim, picture this. You know, it's like 1854, 55 in the country, in the Basque Country, really rural. And 6,000 people show up, and he sings Guernicaco Arbola, and they all get down on their knees and take their berets off and swear allegiance to Basque freedom forever. Hence, the Spanish state says, get out. He lived 19, 20 years in South America and finally came home and died not long after coming home, a kind of dispirited, broken guy. There was a second set of Carlist wars. You know, it never worked. Mm-hmm. There wasn't Basque freedom and autonomy. And then, of course, we all know what happened in the 20th century, another dictatorship in Spain, Primo Rivera, and then Francisco Franco, and it's never ending for these Basque people. So now this poet is in some ways like a kind of Walt Whitman figure, the beginning of something or the transmission of some great grace that is Basque. Except that he was really a conservative too. You know, the work is not modernist in any way. It's all in this very old-fashioned formal rhyme and meter. So in that ways, he's Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson at the same time. The way we have these two kind of poles of our 19th century poets that we think are really central to the identity of American poetry, maybe Yoshimari was kind of both of them at the same time. He's the bohemian of Whitman, the casual guy with a sloppy hat, you know, and the democratic vistas. But he's also Dickinson, quite severe and formal about how he was going to produce this work. Hmm. Well, I hope that's not too many words for the people in the chat.
No, not at all. I think this is fascinating. I wanted to ask more about Basque culture just in general. But why don't you read a poem to start? Like just something that would
one
be
of
good.
His?
Yeah, one of his, and then I'll ask you just to explain what the Basque culture is, because I didn't know much about it and found that fascinating reading just on Wikipedia earlier. But why don't you read a poem just to get everybody a sense of what's going on here?
So an early one, which reflects sort of a couple of the central interests he had. A lot of his poems are either about, I love the Basque Country. They're like patriotic poems. They're poems that kind of make you cringe sometime, because we're not really, in our time right now, a culture of high patriotism. We're a little nervous about patriotism. It can lead to bad things. But for him, because he was struggling for the autonomy of the Basque nation, which has never had autonomy, you know, for 2,000 years since the Romans invaded, it was a big deal. But his other big deal was he was like this cruising cafe, nightclub, guitar-playing guy who had a different girlfriend every time you turned around. So this is one called The Basque Singer on page 31 of the book that you have there, Tim.
Yep.
The Basque Singer. Do you want to hear any of the Basque or just the English?
Why don't we do both? That'd be cool.
Really?
Yeah, sure.
All of the Basque? Okay.
Well, it's a short poem, right? Or is it a longer poem?
Yeah, it's not long.
Yeah, let's do both.
None of them are super long.
That'd be great.
Cantare Euskalduna. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Guitarra sartxo bat da, neretze laguna. Honela ibiltzen da artista Euskalduna. Egun baten pobre, beste batez jauna. Cantare pasatzen det, nik beti eguna. You can hear the rhythm in it, right? So clear.
Yeah.
Naiz dala Italia, orbat Francia, bietan biliatu dut, anitz malizia, ikusten bada ere nik mundu guztia, beti maitatuko dut Euskal Herria. Jaunak ematen badit nire osasuna, izango dut oraindik Andre Gai bat ona. Hemen badet frantsesa interesa duna, baina nik nahiago dut utzik Euskalduna. Agur Euskal Herria, baina ez betiko, bost edo se urtetan ez dut ikusiko. Jaunari eskatzen dio, grazie emateko, nire lur mate ontan ez zurrak usteko. That's the Basque.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
All right, here's the English. Yeah. Called the Basque singer. An old guitar, my only friend. Here's how it goes for the Basque musician. Broke one minute, a gentleman the next. Either way, I spend the day singing. I might be in Italy, but it's the same in France, malice and deceit. Let's say I see the whole world. It'll always be Euskal Herria I love. If the Lord grants me good health, a good woman will still have me, like this French one, rich. But honestly, I prefer a Basque girl. Scuffy, scruffy, broke. Farewell, Euskal Herria. I won't see you for maybe 5-6 years. Well, it's not forever. Here's my last request. Lord, take pity on me. Let my bones rest in my beloved homeland.
Oh, that was great.
So that's very typical of the kind of thing that he does. And always about, will I ever go home to Euskal Herria, mm-hmm. which is the Basque for the Basque country? Will I ever get there? Let my bones rest at home. Let me die at home, you know. And in the end, he finally did die at home. He made it home.
Yeah.
So it's funny because translating him, you know, I knew there's no way I was going to be able to do the rhyme and meter. The languages are so different. And when I teach it, there's some interesting things. I've taught Basque at the university. And, you know, all sorts of students take it because I don't teach it through the language departments. I teach it through cultural studies. So it's part history and part language. It's not like a standard just learn the language class. And I get all kinds of students who are interested, some of Basque heritage. Like if you start learning Basque, the first thing the teachers will ask is, who's your family? Because why would anyone learn Basque if you're not Basque? You know, that kind of thing. But the language doesn't have gender. It's really interesting. So sometimes when I have transgender students, they're so happy that for the first time in their lives, they're going to learn a language that has no gender of any kind in the language. And it's really interesting to try to figure it out, like even in translating, because there's no he, she kind of thing anywhere. So things can be presented and you have to decide, what will you say in English? Will you call that a male voice or a female voice or both voices or a collective voice? How will you figure out to bring the mentality into languages whose sensibility about human beings is dramatically different from one another?
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Translation's a nightmare.
I bet. Yeah, that was one of the things I had no idea until I looked at the Wikipedia page that it's not derived from Indo-European at all. Which that's just mind blowing to me. I don't know, like every language almost, you know, that we speak, and I mean, besides for, you know, there's languages all over, of course, but to have a language in Europe that's not Indo-European. I took Sanskrit in college for a semester, and Sanskrit in India is Indo-European.
Yes,
you know,
it is the.
And so to have a language that has no relationship and dating back to the dawn of agriculture on the Iberian Peninsula, that is amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
It is wild.
It really
so,
is.
So, you know, Basque people sometimes joke about it because a lot of Basque people fled first with the colonial explorers, as it were, to the Americas, where they were very powerful people. They were shipbuilders, the first iron workers. Shakespeare mentions, he calls it the Biscayan Blade, which is where the first ironworks were in Biscaya, which is Bilbao. People would know that probably because of the Guggenheim Museum. It's become kind of a tourist spot. But so many people came here, and they when they went back, the Spaniards did this to some degree too. They had this kind of, I don't know whether you'd consider it just a flat-out stupid racist term or just dumb because it's a different cultural time and historical frame, but those people were called Indianoak. Hmm. That means Indians. Right? They came back from the Americas. But there's a serious side of that for Basque people where they consider themselves to be the native Europeans, the first Europeans before there was a Europe. And the only ones who aren't Indo-European There's no romance connection. That the only language on the Iberian Peninsula that is not romance, and the only one in all of Western Europe that is not Indo-European, the only other one even close, if you think, is would be Turkish. We're not sure whether, you know, Turkey is part Central Asia and part Europe, kind of, but that's the other one that's non-Indo-European. So it's a remarkable thing, and a lot of his poems are about preserving the language. What happens if our language goes away? Do we go away? Because without our language, do we cease to exist? The word for being Basque, Euskaldun, means one with the Basque language. Dun in Basque means with. So a pregnant woman is called Aurdun, which means with child. Like in Americans used to say that, she is with child. So that Dun, Euskaldun, with Basque. You don't speak Basque, you're not Basque. Me, I'm married into a Basque family. But I speak Basque, so I'm Basque for them. Huh. That's another issue. In the U.S., because of the way identity politics works in our country now, that would be unheard of. I can't just walk up and say I've decided to be something else in terms of U.S. history and the horrors and pain of our history. But for Basque people, it is the language that is most centrally the determinant of your cultural affiliation.
Wow.
And that's kind of remarkably... what would you say? It gives us opportunities we don't have.
Yeah.
You know, I have this chance. If I want to say that, well, I've decided I'm going to learn Basque and be part of that world, and they're delighted. Mm-hmm. But of course, they're a tiny culture. So, you know, you count your friends pretty dearly when you're tiny like that. And it matters a lot if somebody cares enough to join up, as it were.
Yeah, that's as a poet, you know, that's beautiful to have the language be the source of identity, I guess. Yeah.
But can you imagine a contemporary American poet writing a bunch of poems about the necessity to save American English?
It wouldn't make any sense.
It just doesn't. It'd be, what is that about?
And so your wife is Basque, and that's how you got into this culture.
Basque
is that
family,
and I guess a group of Basque people in Wyoming? Is that how that happened?
Yes. There was a second wave. I mentioned that a lot of Basque people came because they were shipbuilders. And they were the first whalers in Europe. They also pretty clearly, maybe somebody in the chat knows some about this too. You ought to check and see if anybody pops in. But they followed cod. They found the cod fishing banks off the east coast of Canada. And they were very wealthy and powerful because of cod fishing and whaling. And they wouldn't tell people where they went to get all this cod. And the whale, one of the great whales, is called the Biscayan whale. There is a whale called Biscayan because they migrated up the coast of the Basque Country. So that was the first one. But the second was the California Gold Rush. And that brought a lot of people to California who didn't come directly from the Basque Country. They came from Argentina and Chile, where they'd lived for 100, 200 years. They came to the Gold Rush, but most of them then spread north and east. So there are big Basque communities all over North Central California, and then up through Reno, Winnemucca, you know, all the Nevada, Elko, Nevada, right onto Salt Lake City and across to Rock Springs, Wyoming. And so there are two communities here. I hope this isn't too boring to people.
I think it's fascinating, and that the whole point of the show is to fascinate me. So go ahead.
You know, so the second one was people who actually came through Ellis Island, like other European immigrants, and ended up here coming across from New York. And that group came to North Central and Northeast Wyoming. So there are two batches of Basque people in Wyoming, the part I live in, North Central, Northeast, along the Bighorn Mountains. And they're almost all Northern Basques. In the old days, they would have said French Basque and Spanish Basque. Now people say Northern and Southern because they don't want the identity to go to the two nations.
Yeah.
But we really don't even know how many Basque people ever got to the United States, because if they came through Ellis Island, or even entering through U.S. through a customs port, if they had passports, they would have been Argentine, Chilean, French. There was no such thing as a Basque passport.
Yeah.
So you couldn't. The people who try to figure it out go through the rolls and read the names and try to just say, oh, that's a Basque name. That's a Basque name. You know.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I was wondering about that because the book was published by the University of Nevada, Reno. And there is sort of, you could see, as you mentioned, places that the West, there was a ring of Basque people coming up from there. And Basque Country straddles, I don't know if people know, but it's the northern part of Spain, and it straddles the French-Spanish border. So
Yes,
for the
people
kind
often say it's between France and
of,
Spain. I love the image, which is kind of real metaphorically, because there's not much space between those two. It's about that much.
exactly.
So when you say that, you get this nice metaphor. I mean, it's just the way we talk, but it really is, oh, they're getting crushed by those two big nations, aren't they? Now, of course, it's better. It's way better now for Basque people, partially because Franco was a horrifying dictator, the last of the fascists. You know, Hitler and Mussolini go down, and Franco manages, Franco and in Portugal too, Salazar, they last till 1975, which is crazy. But it meant that the reaction to them was an opening of those societies. And the Spanish Constitution gives Basque people the right to use their language in their schools, which is unheard of, because under Franco, you went to prison for speaking Basque.
How
You
do the
couldn't.
French treat the Basque? Do they do the same kind of welcoming with the language
Historically,
and
they have
things?
done the same, except they tend to use education, economy, finance, opportunity more than just torturing and killing people. The Spanish side tended to use torture and killing a great deal more. But the French were equally vigilant about tamping down regional cultures, largely after the French Revolution. That's what really led to it. Because there was, at the time of the French Revolution, something like 20% of the population of France could speak French.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
So, yes, it was a huge deal. And there is a major study done right after the revolution where a particular priest, French priest, was sent out from Paris. There really wasn't a French revolution, I don't think, Tim. There was a Paris revolution, you know. And then they created a France. And part of creating was he came back with this big report traveling around the national entity and said, you know what? Nobody can speak French in this country. We're not going to have a nation until everybody can speak French.
Oh,
And
wow.
so they instituted schools and they made the rules that you cannot use the regional languages in the schools, in the public sphere, hospitals, courts, all that. So, for example, now in the northern French country, in France, you can't go to public school in Basque. If you want to go to school in Basque, you have to go to private school.
Oh, wow.
It's not outlawed, but in the southern part of the country, the public schools in the Basque country are in Basque. And Spanish is taught as a second language. Of course, everyone can speak it. I mean, they're surrounded by Spanish. You know, it's not a problem. People are so bilingual. Some young people have said to me when I've kind of argued for try to separate, could you speak Basque now and then speak Spanish? Because if you're an American who doesn't speak Spanish, it's very hard to learn Basque without it. And many of the young people will say to me, you don't understand. We don't speak Spanish and Basque as two things. They're one language. We spent our entire lives speaking the two of them. So they will just go back and forth all the time, constant back and forth. And I think maybe the Americans have to face up to the fact that they have to learn Spanish first.
Well, you want to read one more poem from this book, maybe?
Yeah, sure. What do you have one in mind? Did you look at it?
I
Were
did.
you able
I don't
to?
know if I could pull out one that I'd recommend off the top of my
Yeah.
head, but whatever you want to
Okay. Let's see. You know, there's an interesting one that might be maybe this one, which is interesting because it also leads us to problematic issues in translation. It's called Belle Serena. You want to hear the Basque again or just the English?
How long? What page is it, first of all?
It's on page 104 and 105. It's four
Yeah, let's do
stanzas,
both
little.
again. Yeah, they're short
Okay.
again. Yeah,
Belle Serena.
let's do
Here's Belle
both.
Serena. Bel serena naizela, kalean diote. E naiz zuri ederra, arrazoia dute, eder zuri galantak pausuan amabi. Bel serena, graziosak, miliaetatik, bi. Bel serena naizela, zuk nere esateko, lehenago zen denbora erreparatzeko. Beltzak eta zuriak mendien ardiak. Zuk ere ez dituzu bentaia guztiak. Bel serena graziosa, parerik gabea mundu guztiak dio zerala nerea, munduak jakin eta zuk ez jakitea. Ondo egiten dezu disimulatzea. Sarritan amodioz dizut begiratzen arreta guztiakin, errespetatutzen. Begiak beltzez beltzak, itz hori donoso. Ez dut mutilak behar horren amoroso. There's a lot of Spanish in that, mixed up in there. So I've translated it as black. Bel Serena, black. Here it is, and then we'll say a few words about it. The street gossips say I'm black, not a lovely white. They're right. White beauty queens? a dozen at every step. Black women who've got away with words, 2 in 1,000. As to me being black, it took you a while to notice. She's black! Black and white sheep on the mountain. You can't have everything. Incomparable black beauty. Everyone says you're mine. You do a good job pretending not to know what the world knows. Again and again, I look at you. Really look. Bow lovingly before you. Eyes blacker than black. Your way with words. Such love is not for little boys.
Oh, that is a cool one, yeah.
It's very weird because, you know, at that time in their history, there wouldn't have been African heritage people in the Basque Country hardly at all. Basque Country was fairly isolated from the kind of currents of mixture that the Americas have been marked by, and the creation of new peoples out of mixing and some isolation of peoples. So Belts in Basque can also mean dark-haired, dark-eyed, dark-skinned, dark person, dark spirit. And Belts also was a way, like, if we read Elizabethan literature, sometime we know that for a ruling class, upper-class woman in the Elizabethan period, to have tan skin, dark brown skin, was shameful. Hmm. Like, only poor peasants, only people who had to work in the fields in the sun had that. That's in the Basque too. So he might be saying black means a peasant woman rather than an African woman. Mm-hmm. And for a Basque person, it would still be the word belts, but it could be he's mocking the pretensions of the upper class rather than mocking the baloney of some racist impulse in the culture. It's hard to tell. And when we bring it forward now, 175 years, where are we? It could be either thing.
Yeah, the ambiguity is fascinating in that poem. That's a good one.
Yeah, pretty interesting. And that he, you know, sides with her. Whatever it is that is her outcast quality, we don't know. But the speaker sides. And then, of course, the joke about every Basque person's a sheep herder when he says, black and white sheep on the mountain, you can't have everything. You know, whatever that means.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Yeah, that was really cool. Yeah, thanks for sharing those. And beautiful to hear in the Basque. Do you want to, you have the new book coming up, No Way. And we have just a little bit of time left. But do you want to talk a little bit about that? It's interesting. You say at the beginning, I don't know if I can find it. You say that it's a an American Tao Te Ching.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of, weirdly, of I'm not gonna say the name, Jose Marie.
Yeah, Yoshimari.
Yoshimari, yeah. Traveling so much around the world, and then you've lived in Africa, you have poems in Dilemmas of Angels based in, I think, Nicaragua.
Yeah, I worked in Nicaragua. And
you have the angels in the last book, and then you're going back to the Tao in this book. You really travel around at least mentally. As much as he did. Do you find that traveling is and living in different places and experiencing different cultures is a really central part of poetry to you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Should I say more?
Yeah. Well, you could just either say more or you could read some poems from this.
Well, I will say more, Tim, because I can always say.
Okay.
I grew up in Southern Arizona, and I grew up in a very mixed Anglo-Chicano, Anglo-Mexicano community. And so I had a sense of, I don't know, being in that mixed world right from the get-go as a kid. And when I grew up, it suddenly hit me. In high school, we were kept isolated from one another a lot. And I didn't notice, I don't think. This is something that people are talking about a lot now, white privilege, that you get a benefit by being the Anglo. We didn't use the word white, it was Anglo. But the benefit often, I think, like a lot of young people, I didn't notice till I left. And then it suddenly hit me how unfair the treatment had been to all of us, because we were stripped of our togetherness, what we would have gotten from each other in some ways. So a lot of my life has been to try to find a way back towards the integration of those two parts of my childhood, the border part that's Mexican and United Statesian. So that's very influential in my work. But I wasn't trained as a poet ever. I couldn't imagine being I didn't grow up in a house with books or reading. My dad didn't finish elementary school. I went to college as an American studies, politics, history, largely major. And that's what I was interested in. But I started thinking about poetry, and I discovered through people on the West Coast, you probably would know that in the 50s, 60s, 70s, Asian poetry was very influential for West Coast poets, from the Buddhist poets, from what was often called the bear shit in the woods school of poetry, mm-hmm. right? And I got really interested in the Chinese poets. I've read them all my life, the poets from the 7th to the 12th century of the Common Era. And so suddenly I found myself wanting to do something after writing Dilemmas and thought, I think I'd like to just go through the Tao and write modern versions of the Tao. And the way I did it is I tried to write pretty directly, what would happen if you wrote it now? And then I put it away for months and I'd take it out and without looking at the Tao, I'd revise my poem. And then I'd put it away and take it out without looking at my first version and revise the second one, then the third and the fourth and the fifth. So it's sort of like a personal version of the cocktail party game telephone.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And the poems kept getting farther from the original Tao. And finally, I started just leaving them completely to themselves and trying to make them be what it would be now. Mm-hmm. But I still think there are links that are really important to think about. And the power for me of poetry to transmit us across the barrier of death and time so that I have some relationship with some, I don't know, Han Shan. You may know Han Shan, Cold Mountain in English. This crazy wandering hermit, monk, Buddhist poet from 1,000 years ago, you know, that I feel kind of like is some companion. And then there are weird little voices too. Like, for example, we think a lot about the ways in which some peoples are submerged in cultures. Who doesn't get to speak? Whose voice do we not hear? Who gets buried 1,000 years later? But if you dredge around enough, you find some of these hidden voices. There's a guy named John Balaban. I don't know if you know this poet.
Yeah, we published him.
And you know he's done this work with Vietnamese women's poetry from a long time ago. Voices that were completely locked away from us. Unbelievable work to bring this back, these voices. So the ancient times speak to me a lot too. That's part of why I did it.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear you talk about that because that was my experience reading the poems that I did of it. That you could hear the echoes moving forward. It was sort of like listening, really like listening to sort of a shout of the Tao Te Ching, like across the canyon. You can't make out all the words, but it was sort of there too. It was really a fascinating book. Yeah.
Like that. Do you want to hear any of those?
Yeah, why don't you? We only have a little bit of
time. Do we have?
Just maybe, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, but why don't you read two of them maybe?
Yeah, let me read one in case there are people there who don't know the Tao.
Yeah.
Maybe the very first one in the Tao. It's the most famous one, mm-hmm. you know, that everybody has heard at some point if they get near this book. And then I'll read the one I did, and then maybe we'll get to one farther away. Maybe one you can pick, and we'll be done.
Yeah, that'd be good. Okay? Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, so number one, the Tao doesn't have names. They're just numbered. And number one goes like this. This is in Stephen Mitchell's translation, and I think the Stephen Mitchell translations are tremendously fine, really good. There are lots of translations, and his have a nice feel for what an American reader might take. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The unnameable is the eternally real. Naming is the origin of all particular things. Free from desire, you realize the mystery. Caught in desire, you see only the manifestations. Yet mystery and manifestations arise from the same source. This source is called darkness. Darkness within darkness, the gateway to all understanding. So that's the Stephen Mitchell first, number one in the Tao. And mine is, number one is, I gave them names. It's called The Names, the first one. No way I'm telling you my secrets. I'm not even telling you my name. It's David. The Lord told Adam to name everything, then said, but when you talk to me, there's no need to use my name. I'm the only one here. It's not as if things were so mysterious. A fool knows that when he sees the moon shimmer in the black water of a midnight pond, it's not the real moon. The sun rises and the water goes blue. The moon, so clearly present moments before, grows dim as the water grows bright, darkness lending the other a sliver of light.
Yeah, that's such a great echo of that poem in there.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
It really is.
It's just nutty to think about doing it this way. And, you know, it starts as a big joke, mm-hmm. kind of, And part of it is because those old Chinese poets, the before Zen Buddhism, when Buddhism first came to China, they were kind of jokesters, tricksters. They were often filled with whacked out humor. You know, they were always getting drunk and falling out of boats in ponds somewhere while looking at the moon. And, you know, one of the most famous lines in Buddhism is, "Don't mistake the pointing finger for the moon." You know, and so the joking, it starts right out with a joke. It's like tone setting. And then it suddenly somehow gets more serious, becomes more Tao-like.
Yeah, I was
You
wondering
got one?
about the about making it American. Like, what do you think? I think about this a lot because we get poetry submissions from all over the place and reading other poets. Like, what is the difference between an American poet versus other poets? To me, I kind of feel like American poetry is much more grounded in time. I kind of feel like that is what, like, we have very concrete sort of objects and like we're set in a time and place in a way that there's a timelessness to poetry from other cultures. Do you feel like that, or how do you conceive of what's American about the book?
What a bad man you are, Tim. What's American about the book? Well, here are a couple of things I think about that. One, I think to root, and it's kind of what you're saying, to root in specificity is something that has happened from the rise of modernism in American poetry. And you remember the painters who were called the Ashcan School, who would paint ugly things, and how poets also became very involved in this idea. Is it possible to not just write pretty flower poems? Is it possible not to write only about elevated things? So that was a modernist impulse that I think really took root strongly in American poetry and took root along with the painting school, the Ashcan school, so that our work is also very visually driven. I know that's true for me, and I think it's true for a lot of American poets, that you find your way through visual imagery as much as through sonic properties. You know, the whole fight about it, is a poem if it didn't rhyme, that we thought was done thousands of years ago. But, you know, in our particular cultural background, there's some baggage still about that. But the imagistic way of thinking is a very beautiful way to associate one thing with another. So I think that's a very American thing. And I think specificity is, and I also think what you said, a focus on what this experience is. And that comes from the beginning, from Whitman, from William Carlos Williams and that lineage, as opposed to, say, the more British lineage, like the T.S. Eliot line that went to Europe, the ones that said, "I'm going to be an American," whatever that means. And like when I mentioned Kim Adonizio in the beginning, her work, I think her work very much comes in that line of we are here now.
Exactly. That's a great example. Good answer. And very fascinating. Thank you. I'm trying to find a poem that I could recommend. I can't find one right away. So why don't you just pick something?
From No
Yeah,
Way?
from No Way to close us out. Whatever you want to like close on.
Oh, interesting. Let's see what a good one would be from No Way at the end. Let's see. Oh, you know what might be nice? Because you started out talking about children. I read the daughter poem and you spoke about your experience becoming a father. There's one of these in the book. There's a daughter poem. It's called At the Creek. Should I go ahead and read
Yeah,
it?
what page is it on, do you know?
Well, I don't know the page
Okay,
numbers because I don't have a book
maybe
yet.
I can find it on the table of
Let's
contents. Let
see.
me see.
It's about number 8, 9, 10,
Okay,
something like
I'm at
that in
the.
it.
Here we go. 16, it
You see
says.
it? 16. Oh, I'm way off. At the Creek.
Yep,
Ready?
go ahead.
Okay. I go to the creek with my daughter. We squat at the water's edge and look around. Some pebbles, a few sticks, a cottonwood leaf. With these, we make a tiny world in which nothing moves. Would that be heaven then, where all things come to rest? It's as if I stand once again by my desk on the first day of school, and the teacher calls my name, and I say, "Here." She looks up and smiles at me, and I at her. "Here," I say again. "Here."
That was a wonderful poem. That was At the Creek, poem number
Yeah, at
eight
the
from
creek.
No Way, David's forthcoming book. And when is that book coming out from LSU Press?
It's scheduled for next late winter, early spring. You know, it's their spring list, so they usually come out February, Marchish.
Awesome. Well, yeah,
The
really,
book's
everybody should look
pronounced.
forward to this book. I read a whole bunch of these. I didn't read all the way through, but I loved it. So everybody pick up a copy when it comes out and pick up Dilemmas of the Angels too. And the Book of Basque Translations. Wonderful poetry, great discussion. Thanks so much, David. It's great to have you as a guest
Thank you.
today.
Thank you very much, Tim. And thanks to everyone who would watch us blabber at one another for this time. I'm very grateful that anyone might even dare to listen. So
Yeah, well, I feel the
thanks to
same
all.
way. I feel like I'm just having a fun conversation, enjoying some poetry, and that people want to watch too is a wonderful blessing. So thanks so much, David. It's great to talk to
Okay, thanks.
you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, so that was David Ramsvet. And once again, you can find his more of his books. He has over a dozen books. David Ramtvedt, that's ROMTVED.com. So check that out when you can. I had a lot of fun with that, and I hope you did too. Let's move on to the open mic. Not the open mic, the, well, it is open mic. The open mic prompt section of the night. And let me show you the phone numbers. Let's get rid of David by David. The phone number, as always, is 818-850-7727. Give that number a call. Let it ring a few times, and I'll call you back. Or send a Skype message to Rattle Poetry, all one word, if you'd like to read. And once again, I will call you back when the time is right. And if you wrote a poem based on the prompt that you'd like to share, send it to that email address, openmic@rattle.com, so everybody can read along as you read it. Now, this week's prompt was, let's move this down. Hang on one second. Boop. Okay. This week's prompt was write a poem about a phobia you have. Write a poem about a phobia you have. So once again, if you did, email it to, you got plenty of time, email it to openmic@rattle.com right now. And then send me a phone call to 818-850-7727 or a Skype message to Rattle Poetry, all one word, and I'll give you a call and have you read it for everybody on air here. Now, my poem for this week, I'm working on short forms, which helps because I don't spend a lot of time on it, is so we have, I just tell you the background. We took Sunday off. We took the weekend off, actually, pretty much completely. I played some tennis. We went for hikes. I watched Hamilton for the first time after too many years. That was amazing. It's, a lot of things are not all they're cracked up to be. Hamilton was. And then we went for a hike Sunday morning. So I didn't do Poets Respond Live this week. I thought it'd be nice to have a week off or a weekend off. And while I was doing that, I sat down for just a second and got right back up to put away the food or something. And Megan said, "You're always moving. Can't you just sit still?" And I kind of realized that is my phobia of sitting still. Usually I have like three things going on at once. Even as I'm working on like three projects at the same time. And after everybody goes to bed, I work. I'm kind of a workaholic. And so I thought maybe fear of idleness is my phobia. We also have ants going on, an ant invasion in our kitchen, which happens every summer here in the mountains overlooking the high desert, because they're desperate for some water. And so I combined the two, and this is my poem for the week. This is Theasophobia, fear of idleness. The ants in the cupboard keep moving until dead, holding the ivermectin high above their heads. Kind of dark, but that's my poem for the day. Theasophobia. Now, Megan's poem is Agoraphobia. It's shameful, the secret joy at seeing a closed sign, the way the phrase stay home glitters like Christmas. I hide my relief the way one might spit a bite of gristle into a napkin. Why am I like this? Is it because as a chubby teenager with bad posture, I learned that groups of people meant whispers, that walking through one was like parting a sea that refused to be parted? Is it because I watched too many documentaries about serial killers? In public, I tug at my clothes, smooth my hair, catch sight of myself in a window and cringe. I want to ask cashiers what they think of death and love, and when they ask me, how are you, I want to say it's complicated. Because isn't it always? Once a friend sitting in my backyard asked me, "Don't you ever want to just do something?" I look at the trees and the birds and thought, "This is it. This is what I'm doing." He left to go to a bar, and I stayed to listen to the language of crickets. No questions, no answers, just music. That was Megan's poem for today, Agoraphobia. Now let's see what you all did. We have a whole bunch of people lined up to call in. Who was the first on the list? Let's see. Caitlin Bucksbaum's got a poem ready. Let's call up Caitlin. Let's find Caitlin's poem, too.
Hello.
Hey, Caitlin, how you doing tonight?
Pretty.
Oh, hang on. Let me pull you in. You're not on yet.
Hey, man. The ringer makes me jump. I'm like so focused on what's being said.
Well, we got you. We got you. I should always tell everybody, you know, that I'm going to call from the future. So you'll be surprised when I call you. You're the expert, so you know it's coming, the surprise. But it always comes.
And still. Yeah.
So what was your phobia for this week, Caitlin?
Okay, so I could not bring myself to write a poem about a specific phobia because it's a phobia. But also, I was like, the internet doesn't need to know what I'm afraid of. So I wrote a poem that references phobia that I didn't intend to write for this, but I wrote it and I was like, you know what? I think I will share this. So okay. It's still pretty fresh and still.
Awesome. Let's go for it. So it's What We Bury, and it's ready to go whenever you'd like. Mm-hmm.
What we bury. What we bury has as much bearing on our fate as how we bury it. I wrap unwelcome thoughts in newspaper, crumple them up and encase them in concrete, then launch my handmade meteorite into outer space. Sometimes I watch it compress, then fall and fall and fall. And if I'm still watching, I see it consumed by an immeasurable black hole. When the sin or phobia is great enough, I might observe the rocket that transports it in meticulous detail, mapping its flight pattern out of the atmosphere before following the trajectory of my intellectual waste into nothingness. What we bury has as little bearing on our fate as how we bury it.
Very nice. I love the last couplet that was, or last stanza there. What We Bury by Caitlin Bucksbaum. Thanks so much for joining us and sharing that, Caitlin.
Yeah, it was just kind of like when I have a thought that freaks me out, that's sort of my process of dealing with it. So,
yeah.
There you go.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Have a good night.
Yeah, you too.
Bye. Let's see. Who is next? We'll call up 270 and see who that is. And I still have not written down people's actual names with their phone numbers. I have to do my contact list sometime. But we'll see who 270 is.
Hello?
Hey, this is Tim from Rattle. Did you want to share a prop poem tonight?
Yeah.
And who am I talking to?
This is Cameron Gray.
Ah, hey, Cameron. Good. Thanks so much for joining us. Let me see. Let me try to find it.
I emailed it recently.
Okay. Let's see.
I think the subject says phobia.
Phobia is okay. July 17th. I'm not seeing it here. Gmail to openmic@rattle.com. This happened last time too, actually. Refresh.
Yeah.
Oh, here it is. It just came in seconds ago. Okay.
Okay.
So this is Yes Dear. And do you want to say anything about what it's about?
I think it's self-explanatory. I don't think there's an actual name for the fear that I'm talking about, but I think you'll get it, hopefully.
Okay, well, give me
one. I'm just going to read it.
Okay, 1 second, and I will get it up. I want to make sure I don't show your email address. Okay, here we go. Oops. Hang on, just bear with me for 1 second. Okay, here we go. I got the right thing. This is Yes, Dear.
Okay. Yes, Dear. Arvel Gray was his name. He lived in a hospital bed with my great-aunt, Mayetta, his eyes never able to meet mine. Sometimes he would jerk, thrust his hands up, grab the air, and bounce. Mayetta would say, "Are you driving your tractor, Daddy?" Always circling around, emptying bags and changing tubes. At every visit, there were syringes administering medication with no reaction from Papaw. Vegetables come from the garden. They are delicious with butter. Why call him a vegetable? Let's just say I never got it. Aneurysms. When a perfectly good brain decides to start blowing bubbles, leaving a shell of a man that didn't even know I was there. Arville came from the garden, and a group of sad, scared, selfish people waited far too long to return him. So, yes, dear, I understand perfectly when you say, please don't ever let them do that to me.
Oh, that was a heartbreaking poem and great reading. Thanks so much for sharing that with us. And it was Cameron Gray. Cameron Gray, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, very powerful poem. Thanks so much, Cameron. Let's see, who is next? Let's go with Michelle Parks. Hey there, Michelle. How are you doing tonight?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good. Good. I don't know if you want to turn your video or not, but if you do, you haven't hit it yet.
Yeah, I was trying to. I'm not very multi-talented.
Well, that's all right. So your poem was Journals. Do you want to say anything about what your phobia was?
It's a mix of phobias, I think, because I love writing, and I love going to open mics occasionally, but it's gotten harder for me over the years because of my physical disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's something about putting yourself out there because it's like releasing your security blanket. Words become like your walls and your comfort, and when you're letting go of them, it's kind of opening you up to this rawness that you may not be prepared for. So I have a terrible fear of publication, of actually submitting points to be wider spread to the world, I guess. And you could call it like doxophobia,
yeah,
or something like that, but it's not so much a fear of being praised as it is of losing those pieces of myself and not knowing what's left, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does. That's really interesting. Yeah, doxophobia. And your poem is Journals. It's ready to go whenever you're ready.
Awesome. Journals. All those years wrapped in soiled tissue beneath pink lipstick kisses. Words I never had courage to whisper, so I pricked my tongue, bled them on paper. So easy to lose the truths we uncover, those about life, pain, love. It's been a lifetime since I cried those tears. Still I choke on the rust.
Awesome. Thanks so much for sharing that. That's Michelle Parks with Journals. Always great to hear from you, Michelle. Thanks so much for calling in and sharing the poems out in the world this way.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Have a good night.
You too.
You have a lot of people. I'm not sure if we're able to get to everybody because it's already 7:26. I do have to get the kids to bed, but let's try the 773 number. See who that is.
Hello.
Hey, this is Tim with Rattle. Did you want to share a poem?
I did. Hey, it's Jessica.
Hey, Jessica. I thought I recognized your voice. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm great. Yeah, having a good night. I really liked talking to David. It was a fun episode for me.
It was really informative, too.
It was, like, yeah. He's like a wealth of knowledge. Yeah, definitely. I bet he's a good teacher. That was one of the things I was thinking. So what was your phobia poem?
Well, I kind of feel like a fool because the second I called this number to get my place in the queue, I was like, why the hell didn't I make my phobia a fear of public speaking? I actually wrote about, so I guess it's called thanatophobia, which is referred to as death anxiety. I understand I'm going to die. I'm not ignorant of it. I just have a problem of, I don't want to. I can't really explain it, but if anybody else has it, they'll be able to understand it. But I've been like reading things about dying to get comfortable about it, and I'm just like still not there. So
I don't know if it will help, but the thing I always think of is you know, before you were born, you were already in the same state as when you were dead, right? And so
it's
you've already
so
experienced
unfair.
The same thing, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. But now that I am aware of my existence, it seems not great to just have it go away.
Yeah,
well,
definitely. I would prefer not to lose mine either. So, so this is God willing. It's ready whenever you are.
Okay. First, I'm going to say a quote. I understand that Woody Allen is definitely a part of the cancel culture, but he had a great quote, and it's, I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens. And I feel like that sums me up.
Yeah, that is a good quote. Right. Okay.
So, God willing, I'll be in a clean pair of underwear when I go, and hopefully it won't be messy or tragic or wildly preventable or by my own hands or uncomfortable in any way, or when I'm too young or right before my kid's birthday, because that really fucks a kid up, I should know. And I hope if the radio is on, it's playing a good song and not some commercial for Mattress Firm, which must be a front for something illegal, because I never see anyone shopping at one, but somehow they're everywhere. God willing, my world won't ever go black on me unless I'm sleeping, and even then it's a little scary, because I wouldn't know if I didn't wake up, and that would mean you didn't wake up, because how could a world exist that isn't the world I see when I'm awake? And how could you exist outside of me if I am no longer here, breathing the air, rotating the earth, orbiting the sun, carrying the galaxy? God willing, I won't lose the universe.
Oh, that's a great poem. Thanks so much. It was Jessica Dawson with God Willing. It's so funny that you brought up Mattress Firm. There's one right across the Target from where we, you know, go to Target. And we always say the exact same thing, that if that's not a money laundering front, I don't know what is.
Oh, it's the perfect one. Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. Every mattress was $8,000, IRS, I swear. Anyway.
Nobody's buying a mattress in a store these days either.
I know,
they're
really. Yeah.
Online in a box like we did. Like
that is bizarre.
Anyway.
Someone needs to do like an investigation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, well, thanks so much for calling and sharing that, Jessica. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Have a great night.
You too. Let's see who we can have here. Hey, this is Tim with Rattle. Did you want to share a poem?
Sure, Tim. It's Kathy Gibbons. How are you
tonight?
Ah,
good. Hey, Kathy. How are you doing tonight?
Good. I cheated a little bit. I didn't write this poem this week, but it is about a phobia, so I wasn't sure.
That's okay. Yeah, let's go ahead and hear it. And what's your phobia?
It's about water. It's kind of thoughts about things that we are afraid of that are still essential to us. And so how do you do that, you know?
Yeah. Well, go ahead whenever you're ready. It's on the screen.
Okay. It's called Sometimes When It's Wet, I Dream of Dry, as if that could quench my thirst. How strange to think I am afraid of water still. Sitting at my desk in grade school in the winter, I contemplate the depth and danger of the ocean where I swim so free each summer. How could I dare? Sitting at this table as an elder in September, I contemplate this simple glass of water and remember when my city drowned. How could I live? But then I did. Imagine we're the bubble balanced at the top. Some wild child whooshed us through a wand, clapping hands, delighted till we shrank and landed flat. Still room to rise above. Beneath us, undiscovered emptiness. Water speaking volumes, framed by glass striated curtains. Some kind of clear kaleidoscope waiting to be spun. How strange to be afraid of water still. Floating, wrapped in call within a womb. How dare I doubt? How could I live without?
Thanks so much. That was Kathy Gibbons from Houston, which is a worthy of note, sharing Sometimes When It's Wet, I Dream of Dry, as if that could quench my thirst. Really great poem. Thanks, Kathy. How are things doing?
Heavy poem.
What's that?
That was a post-Harvey poem.
Yeah, so I was going to say, how are things now with Harvey? Is it sort of like everything is back to normal, well, or were some things like ruined beyond repair?
Well, the dams were never really repaired to where they should be. So I'm living in a little bit of fear right now because of the virus, coupled with the potential of hurricanes coming in.
Definitely. Same thing here. We're right on the fault. So I'm thinking, like, God, if we have the San Andreas fault going right when there's a pandemic or a forest fire, I don't want two things at once. Yeah.
So many phobias, right? And my main one is someday I would like to show my face on Skype, but God, I have a big phobia about that. So.
Okay, well, anyway. Whenever you're ready, we'll have you be your first time showing your face on the internet. Okay.
Thank you, Tim.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Kathy. Always great to hear from you. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, let's do one more. Trying to do somebody. I think we'll do just one more. I know Angela and Richard Westheimer, you guys are on a lot, so I think we'll skip you tonight. Sorry, everybody. There's just not enough room for everybody. But I don't think we've done the 706 number, so we'll see who that is.
Hello?
Hey, this is Tim with Rattle. Did you want to share a poem for the prompt?
Yes.
And who am I talking to?
Mira Bade Carr.
Thanks so much for calling in. Let me try to find your poem. Did you email it to me?
Yes. It was about 4 days.
Oh, okay. I see it down here. So that is latrophobia. What is latrophobia? I've never heard of that one before.
It's a fear of doctors.
Ah, interesting. Is there anything you want to say about it, or do you just want to read the poem?
I think I just want to read it because I don't say the word doctors. I wonder how it reads.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Well, go ahead whenever you're ready. Latrophobia.
Okay. I lived with my dad in the summer. I'd wake in the morning contracted, feeling like I was in the bay across the street, tossed around like sand and seaweed, filled to the brink with salty water. Heavy minerals settling, then scattering, clinking and colliding in my gut. I'd ask to stay home from camp. He'd tap his feet, blow steam from his ears, concentrate a gaze at his wristwatch, as if to ask it to stop moving, stop ticking. He'd fall to his knees to pray, lean over my bed to plead with me, and climb the ceiling like a giant spider, venom dripping from his mouth, webs spinning around me. He'd come back down, take me to the hospital. They'd ask me why I wouldn't talk. My eyes would be swollen at that point, red and webbed, pupils darting downwards from policing eyes, the strangers with their clipboards. A decade later, I sat in a room with a dozen or so, women and girls. We were called out one by one after taking a giant Vicodin or two, Pinocchio playing on a TV from the 80s, set against the linoleum tile, pool green walls, and myself, also from the 80s. Then a child's portion of out-of-season watery fruit from Denny's, dancing in my stomach. I thought of my womb. I thought of the men wanting this from me and their child's portion of responsibility. The strangers called me to a room. A white-haired man, a black-haired woman, laid me back on a blue-green table, told me I wouldn't feel it, and pinched my cervix with the frozen edge of metal. I screamed. They spun a web around me. Their eyes flashed red and wide, like a ticking alarm clock. Their rhythmic reprimands echoed inside me, and my eyes were swollen and damp when they finished, or rather vanished from my sight. They've never finished, the strangers.
Oh, powerful poem. Thanks so much for sharing that. Yeah, very memorable. And that, once again, that was... Mira Bade Carr. Yeah, thanks so much for sharing that.
Yes. Mira,
great to hear from you. Always lovely to have first-time callers too.
Yeah, I was nervous, but thanks.
Well, you did great. It was an excellent reading and a really, really powerful poem. So thanks for sharing it.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Bye. So that is the show for tonight. Hope you enjoyed it. Sorry to everybody we couldn't get to. There's like five more people on the list, but I really have to get going. It's. I want to end these at. After 90 minutes, and it's 98 so far. So, but next week, we'll definitely get to you if we didn't this week. Now, next week on the Rattlecast, let me show that really quick, the poet will be Courtney Campa. in her book, Our Lady of Not Asking Why. Courtney Campa, kind of a reclusive poet. It's hard to track her down, but an amazing, amazing poet starting, I think she was one of Gregory Orr's students, and she started winning or becoming finalists for the Rattle Poetry Prize like year after year with really wonderful poems. She was winner of the Reader's Choice Award, I think, one of those years. Yeah. So we published about maybe 8 of her poems, and just a wonderful poet. Looking forward to talking to her next Tuesday. And I almost forgot, like I keep doing, because by the time we move through, there's so much going on. I almost forgot to do the prompt for next week. So let me do the prompt for next week. And the prompt for next week is, write a poem in a form you've never tried before. So that's next week's prompt. Write a poem in a form you've never tried before. Pretty open-ended. And Megan has a suggestion for everybody. Writer's Digest has compiled a great list of poetic forms. You can go to, if you just type in Writer's Digest poetic forms, it'll come up, but there's the URL on the website. Friend of the show, Robert Lee Brewer, is sort of the poetry editor, I think maybe his title for Writer's Digest. And he compiled this list, originally 50 forms. Now there's 100 forms. Actually, I could show that on screen. Yeah, here it goes as well. Doesn't really fit. But a list of 100 poetic forms for poets. So check that out. Find a form you haven't written before and then write a poem in that form. So that is the prompt for next week. And next week's guest will be Courtney Campa in Rattlecast number 51. We will also, as always, we'll have the critique of the week on Friday at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. And I think we will have the open mic show on Sunday. I think what we're going to do for the open mic, just if you're wondering, for Poets Respond Live, is when there are enough poems with enough like different subjects going on, we'll have a Poets Respond Live. I'll make a post on Facebook and Twitter, so check that Saturday, and I'll let you know, or you can check YouTube. There'll be a YouTube, you know, the video will be up the day ahead of time. But if we get enough poems where there's a good sort of diversity and interesting topics, we'll do Poets Respond Live. And if it's sort of a slower week, we won't. I think that's how we're going to do it from now on. So it's sort of going to be a hit and miss on Sundays. I hope that's okay for everybody. If there's enough people who want to do it every week, regardless, even if it's a short show, let me know. Maybe we'll just do it every week. But it is the summer, and Poets Respond submissions tend to die down a little bit in the summer as people are sort of enjoying the weather and things like that, which is understandable. And after the big coronavirus sort of onslaught of poems, the deluge, things are have slowly come back to normal. So we're getting about 200 submissions a week instead of 1,000. So it makes more sense to do it sort of some weekends and some not. So I think that's what we're going to do. But let me know what you think if you want. And that is all. Once again, next week's guest is Courtney Campa, and I will see you then. Have a great rest of your week. Good night.